When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Snapple. Want to know another Snapple fact? The first hot air balloon passengers were a sheep, a duck, and a rooster. Ridiculous. Check out Snapple.com to find ridiculously flavored Snapple near you.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
It's very difficult to keep the line between the past and the present.
Do you believe that someone out of the past can enter and take possession of a living being?
We may be through with the past, but the past is not through with us.
Welcome back to The Next Picture Show, a Movie of the Week podcast devoted to a classic film and the way it's shaped our thoughts on a recent release. I'm Scott Tobias, here again with
Keith Phipps
and
Genevieve Kosky.
Tasha remains ill, just as she was 2 days ago. Come on, Tasha, get it together. In the first half of this conversation, we talked about The War Room, D.A. Pennebaker and Chris Hegedus's groundbreaking behind-the-scenes documentary about Bill Clinton's successful campaign for president. Now we're moving on to Anthony Weiner's spectacularly unsuccessful bid for New York City mayor, which signaled the ignominious end of Clintonism. The co-director of Weiner, Josh Kriegman, served as Anthony Weiner's former chief of staff during his time in Congress, which ended when Weiner accidentally posted a lewd sext on his public Twitter feed. It seems clear, to me anyway, that Kriegman and co-director Elise Steinberg expected Weiner to have a strong chance at a comeback, given the parallels to Bill Clinton, another charismatic politician who overcame his own share of high-profile sex scandals. But when even more evidence of Weiner's sexting comes to the surface, it sabotages both his campaign and his marriage to Huma Abedin, Hillary Clinton's closest advisor and one half of a formidable political power couple. In other words, Weiner was supposed to be about a political talent thrust back into the spotlight, but his poll numbers, that's P-O-L-E, experienced significant shrinkage.
Well done, Scott.
We'll be right back with a mature discussion of these matters after the break.
The punchline is true about me. I did the dumb thing, but I did a lot of other things too. Running for mayor was the straightest line to clean up the mess that I had made.
This is Anthony Weiner calling. Yes, I'm not Anthony Weiner, the one running for mayor.
Why do you think you deserve the second chance?
I didn't want to answer.
I'm giving you the answer.
I thought you were thinking about it. I thought you were trying to think.
No, I'm talking words.
What I'm going to try to talk about is the issues facing New York City.
Are more women going to come to vote?
Just a quick optics thing, you will look happy.
Don't push up, Anthony! Show it to me again!
Oh my God!
I can't believe I gave the press the finger.
How many women were there? Can you remember?
What I would like to talk about is housing in the Bronx. Any questions about that?
Why should we trust your judgment?
We're going to try to look like we're holding together as a group.
I am profoundly sorry. And for that, I am profoundly sorry.
Does the wife's absence say anything?
What is wrong with you?
What is he so afraid of?
Your brother said that your father never hugged you.
Do you believe you're suffering from any sort of addiction?
What are you, the referee over there?
We are staying calm and managing the situation.
You're a real scumbag, Em.
It takes one to know one, jackass.
Why didn't you just walk?
Okay, Keith, Genevieve. What did you make of the documentary Weiner?
First, I just want to say I'm glad we got all the punnage out of our system.
Oh, there's no way we
right
did.
There. Well, it's a goal. It's
okay.
A goal.
Yeah.
what did I make of Weiner? I was cringing the whole time this movie was on. And
yeah.
full disclosure, I did not rewatch it after the election. I watched this before the election, and it burned itself into my brain enough. I felt I could talk about it, but I think it'd be too painful to revisit now because of the domino effect spinning out from this. But not to get too far ahead of us, but I think it is an example of how both the public is willing to forgive, because I think had there not been a subsequent scandal, I think Wiener, I don't know if he would have won, he certainly would have done a lot better, but also the way things, as we discussed in the first half, they stick around, they don't go away.
Genevieve?
I think we all recommended this movie at one time or another on this podcast, so I think all of us, Tasha included, are fans of Wiener, but I agree with what Keith was saying about it being hard to watch after the election. I did, because I am ever the overachieving A student, but it is very difficult to watch knowing what we know about Wiener's potential role in how Hillary Clinton's campaign turned out. I mean, it's a kind of oblique connection, but it's still definitely there. But even before the first time I saw this movie months ago, what stuck out to me most about it then was Huma. Like, mm-hmm. I see like a little division about this in the conversation about the movie, or I saw it at the time. It's like the people who think it's Huma's movie and the people who think it's Wiener's movie. And I am definitely in the this is Huma's movie camp, because I think Wiener is, he's a Wiener. He's hard to watch.
Yeah.
But I think having her in the movie really tells an interesting story about a marriage and about how the two genders can function in politics and in scandal and the different expectations that are put on both of them. And I find it fascinating as a story about that more so than a story about a political campaign kind of gone amok. It is interesting as that, but it is more interesting to me. I mean, my eyes always go to Huma in every scene she's in.
Oh, yeah. I mean, well, for one, I mean, I don't think there's anybody, and this happens early, once things go off the rails, I mean, there's nobody who wants to be on screen less than, mm-hmm. than her in that movie.
As a hostile witness.
She really is, and so much of our impression of him and our feelings about him are reflected through her anger and disappointment, all of which is quite righteous. So I think that's fascinating. But I also find Wiener himself to be just an interesting case of just this pathological narcissist, mm-hmm. and the way things kind of go off the rails for him. And, you know, when he reaches that desperation point, the movie just gets, it's fascinating to me on a psychological level. You know, and when he has that moment where he asks the question, like when he is asked, you know, why are you even letting us film you? I mean, I think that is such a tell. That's a, like, rhetorical question at that point, because
right.
I think that is because Anthony Wiener needs to be filmed. That's why this happened. But to get to the overall arc of the film, I really believe that this was the case of a film that was packaged to be one kind of a film, to tell one kind of a story, which is the remarkable political mm-hmm. comeback of Anthony Wiener as told by, you know, a former staffer and a friend. And it just ended up going south. And it's just one of those great moments in film or in documentary film where you start telling one story and then something breaks out. You get a movie that is richer than they could have possibly imagined it was going to be.
That great montage of him, of his campaign before it goes south, set to, I believe, New York Groove, like just like kind of the energy that you see from him and from the people that he is campaigning to, like you believe it and you mm-hmm. see the charisma that could have led to the outcome that these filmmakers were probably expecting this movie to have. That it didn't speaks to kind of the dark side of that charisma, this narcissism that you mm-hmm. are talking about. And it really does kind of paint a very complex portrait of Wiener while still just making him seem like a total Wiener.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what I'm stuck on too, is that the whole, what makes him work as a candidate up to the point where his scandal overwhelms him is that need to be liked and on camera and expressing himself. And it also is what destroys him. I get the feeling this is someone who doesn't know who he is when he's alone and seeking some kind of gratification in some way, whether that's online sexual activity or, you know, being in front of the camera talking about his campaign, which I can only imagine that he's now a very lonely person.
Who knows what his online life is like at this point. But, I mean, you could see, and the film contrasts this a bit with Bill de Blasio, who would, you know, win that campaign, of Anthony Weiner just on the campaign trail, in parades, being a real people person, somebody mm-hmm. who can just run up to folks in the crowd and relate to them. And if people come at him a little bit, he can banter, he can kind of move. I mean, you can see him as a political talent. And there was a time before in Congress, before this broke out, where among the, you know, hundreds of people in Congress, he stood out as somebody who was combative and would make a scene on the House floor mm-hmm. if necessary in support of the 9/11 rescue workers, mm-hmm. if I recall. Mm-hmm. You know, he would be out of order. He would be on what Bill Maher, I think he was kind of a Bill Maher regular. He's one of those guys who just had that kind of energy. And you get that sense that of the marriage itself being staked on that too, being staked on that hope of just like, this is a political power couple. These are two talented people who complement each other and could, if things go well, could rise to the top together, right?
Yes, but that combative energy that you're talking about is kind of what I mean when I say that this movie functions as a portrait of how men and women function differently in politics, mm-hmm. in that a female politician, like, say, Hillary Clinton, could not really move through the political sphere with the sort of confrontational attitude that Anthony Weiner displays. Mm. And I think that having Huma there, like, okay, so the scene of the movie for me is the one after Weiner is on The Last Word.
Mm, I knew you'd say that one. Yeah.
And it just has kind of a disastrous performance where all that, like, charisma and energy just curdles into mm-hmm. this like tantrum-y performance, and we see him watching the clip of himself on the computer with Huma in the room, and she is just, you can just feel the mortification coming off mm-hmm. of her in waves, and she asks him, she's like, why are you like this? Like, why? This is insane. This is not how a person should act. And he's like, you know, no, it puts more fight in me. And just that mindset of fighting being a good thing and confrontation being the goal is so different than I feel female politicians or just women in the political sphere, how they can act.
No, I think that's a really good point. Yeah, that is my favorite scene of the movie too, because of that contrast. I mean, you do have her and you do feel the mortification coming off her, but you also see him being absolutely delighted by mm-hmm. by himself doing that. And you almost get the impression that he's probably been watching this clip of himself all day long because he just feels like he's been able to have that catharsis or be, you know, as you say, combative and, you know, a fighter without really being conscious of the fact that he's made an embarrassment out of himself.
Do you know of any other documentary that goes so far off what it sets off to film?
Ooh. It's a fun game.
Yeah. I mean, I always think of a movie like Paradise Lost, for example, of being something where you're, you know, they show up, maybe, you know, expecting this trial that might have been open and shut, and end up witnessing this just massive miscarriage of justice and happening in front of the camera.
That becomes their careers for the next.
Yeah,
decade.
It really does. It, right, it's like three movies, but I think there are more examples than that, because I do like it when this happens to documentaries, when it becomes a little more interesting. And I feel weird discussing it now because I can't think of any, and I know there are many of them out there.
Yeah. Listeners, hit us up.
Yeah.
Discuss.
Something that starts as one thing and then becomes another thing entirely. But this one definitely does. But let me offer a premise to you all, because this is an argument that I think the film is trying to make before the Carlos Danger thing happens. And it
becomes, I can't believe we got nearly 15 minutes into this podcast and this is the first time you've uttered the words Carlos Danger.
And we still haven't said Sidney Leathers.
Oh, Sidney Leathers. God almighty. We'll get to that for sure. But the film is trying to, the argument in favor of Anthony Weiner, and I guess it would be the argument you would make in favor of Bill Clinton too, is that there can be, and perhaps should be in the mind of the voter, a separation between private weaknesses or errors or issues within a marriage and what a person can actually do in the office, that a person's judgment can be perfectly fine in one sphere and not so great in the other, and we can separate those two things. Is that a reasonable argument to make, or is that an unreasonable argument to make?
I think had Anthony Weiner reacted differently, it would have been a reasonable argument to make. But I think the way he responded publicly to the scandal and the way we see him responding privately in this film kind of speaks to a character, a mm-hmm. very deep character flaw that I can't imagine not bleeding over into his political life, even if it not necessarily in such an explosive way.
I guess the hypothetical, though, is pre-Carlos Danger. Like, mm-hmm. what if all we knew of him is this one pretty gross, image that he accidentally posted to Twitter, mm-hmm. That was meant for someone else. You know, if we get a couple years distance from that, this relationship is this problem has been worked out through the marriage. What do we think of this?
I think the public is eager to forgive people, candidates, at least once. Mm-hmm. And they can say that and say, you know, nothing criminal was done. He didn't commit adultery. And you can, I think as a voter, you can look to Abedin and say, oh, well, she forgave him.
Mm-hmm. And that was a crucial part of his campaign too. Like they are very explicit about, like there's a line early in the film of a supporter being like, if Huma can forgive him, why can't we?
You know? I don't know what their life was like behind closed doors, but at that point she was very useful to him politically as a smart feminist woman who, you know, has had forgiven him, was going to be okay going forward. Now, when that falls apart, I think your candidacy falls apart. And that's mm-hmm. what we saw here. And I think even after that, you know, after this, he was a New York Daily News, I believe, columnist, and he's on New York One. And all that went away after the most recent scandal, which was, I think, the grossest of the three scandals in Anthony Weiner's.
And that was the one that finally drove Huma away.
I don't think there's any coming back from him. I wonder what her future is as well.
It's utterly tragic story
for her, and it's impossible to ignore the parallels between mm-hmm. Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Anthony Weiner and Huma Abedin, you mm-hmm. know, and especially given the link between Huma and Hillary in their careers. Like it almost feels like that his campaign early on, when they are relying on Huma so much, it is kind of subconsciously calling back to that history between Hillary and Bill and her being able to forgive him and her becoming a political force in her own right. And it definitely seems like a maybe not conscious, but also maybe conscious echoing of that story, of that political story.
And I mean, and at the end of the line, I mean, these women have had to bear so much of the burden of their husbands, you know, infidelities and massive errors. And what do they get? You know, what is their reward? The reward at the end of the line is, you know, being, you know,
humiliated
and not winning and not really having, you know, a future in politics.
Yeah, I mean, I think the trade-off, I mean, what Hillary Clinton lacked that Bill Clinton had was sort of ease and charisma. But I think, you know, Bill Clinton certainly helped her along the way and made her in some ways a more charismatic candidate over the years, just by virtue of association. I think something might have similar have happened here. I don't think that Abedin is very comfortable on camera or
no. I mean, she's a much more behind the scenes person than.
I don't even know what her ambitions are. If she wants to remain behind the scenes or not. But
and I really strongly feel that Bill Clinton harmed her.
Oh, I think
so much more often than he.
I think in the end,
even practically speaking, I mean, just, you know, the Comey thing doesn't happen if Bill Clinton doesn't walk over and start chatting up Loretta Lynch. And there were plenty of times during the campaign where it's like Bill Clinton, where he goes off script and it's like, are you trying to lose this election for your wife? And then of course you just get into the just incredible double standards being applied to male candidates.
But going back further, I'm not sure that Hillary Clinton becomes a national figure without Bill Clinton as sort of the more clearing the way with the machete of charm over the years.
Well, maybe not. Well, this is already getting into territory that we want to get into in connections. So we'll be right back to talk more about how the War Room and Weiner fit together after this.
I just want to look at the questions and talk to you about how you want to answer those. So the answer to, were people in the campaign other than Huma aware? No. Then had there been multiple online exchanges of multiple people, or was it just this one?
This was the last guy's template to put in his information.
Can I just say multiple people, or is it just this one?
I think you've got to. I mean, there was more than one, so I think.
think we've got to answer the question.
Come on, son.
Okay. Problem was that the series of interviews that I did when I got in the race were after this. And people asked me, is the number still the same?
No, there's no exact address.
I think I said to 6 to Dominic, and then I cleaned it up in subsequent interviews because I knew that was a problem. Question is, do we answer it or not? I think we have to answer these questions.
I think we have to answer because if somebody else comes out, we don't.
So, okay. So then you're going to give me an answer.
So I'm going to say...
Yes.
It was more than one. Do you believe you're suffering from any sort of addiction?
Now it's time for connections when we bring these two films together and talk about all the things they have in common. Well, let's continue with what we were talking about in the first half and talk about the Clintons themselves and how they figure into both of these movies, because really they're kind of shadow figures in both cases. You know, we get that nice early scene of Bill Clinton in a hotel in the early part of
in shorts.
Oh, God, those jogging shorts. I don't know. They're powerful.
How can you not become president?
He and Gore. Those jogging shorts. Very powerful. Campaign tool. Campaign tool? Come on, everybody. It's a Wiener joke. So anyway, in any case, and then of course in Wiener, the only real thing we get with Hillary Clinton is that there's a certain amount of pressure for her to leave her husband behind or not be associated anymore with Hillary Clinton's campaign for presidency. That sort of comes up late in the film. But so they're there. They're not there, but they're there.
Yeah.
They're obviously a huge presence in both movies, even if they're not featured on either one.
Well, yeah. And I mean, Hillary Clinton does appear in the War Room in a way she does not appear in Wiener. I think just her name is invoked and we maybe see a photo or something of her in Wiener. Mm-hmm. But, you know, we do get some footage of her in the War Room. It's all like on stage during speeches. But, well, I guess there's a little of her out on the campaign trail, too, talking to people. But it's interesting in the context of Wiener and the election we just went through of like seeing her back in the first lady role. Like, it's been so long, you know, and so much has changed since then. You know, she's got her little bob and bangs and headband and the whole thing going, you know. It's yeah, it was kind of hard, I'm not gonna lie, to see her in the War Room, and obviously hard in a different way to have her invoked in Wiener.
Well, and there's a thing too where even in the War Room, and I believe this is mentioned, that she was going to be a different sort of first lady. That was made clear from the beginning, that she was going to take that role to another level, which indeed she ended up doing.
And she was also a source of more scandal for Clinton. Like, there, we do get that little bit about, I think it's at a debate, like someone brings up him like funneling business to his wife's law firm or something, you know, which is like in the hierarchy of Clinton scandals is just like so low on the list that you know, it just kind of flies by. But it is kind of interesting to see how this marriage between Bill and Hillary Clinton has just had so many ripples throughout the political sphere and throughout the years. It's kind of crazy.
Yeah, I think, are we doing this? Are we still doing this? But like, I feel ultimately more that's ultimately what did her in more than any particular thing. It's sort of this Clinton fatigue in a way. It's interesting to see it in the sort of first blush of the public infatuation with the Clintons in 1992. And then we don't really see it wearing itself out at this, but you can see the beginnings of, Wiener's kind of the beginning of the end, even if anyone in the film itself didn't know it at the time.
Yeah. And with Hillary Clinton in particular, there's a sense that you have, you know, a potentially powerful woman and a leader who isn't in control of her own destiny in the end, because ultimately, I mean, you could talk about four or five different things that swung the election to Donald Trump in 2016.
Only four or five?
So many. I mean, you talk about a lot of things, but the one thing that the Clinton campaign hung on to was the Comey stuff, which is the link to Anthony Weiner. And that's just, again, that is nothing that she had any control over. That is something that became an issue because of his flaws and his misbehavior. It's a tragic political story for her and for whom, obviously. One of the other things that really strikes me about these two films, too, is just the time in which they're made and the tools which were used to make them. The War Room was shot on 16mm. If you're shooting on 16mm, you're burning film. It's costing a lot of money, and you have to really think about when you want that camera turned on. Even if you're embracing this fly-on-the-wall style, you've got to make some choices. Otherwise, the film gets prohibitively expensive. Wiener is a film that was shot on digital video, and you can just keep the camera running constantly. And so there's not this thing in the War Room. There are these gaps that you kind of have to fill in, you know, based on what you understand of how that campaign played out and based on your fixed perspective of that campaign from within the War Room and not from the outside of it. Wiener is really, you know, you're riding shotgun the whole time, and there's a level of intimacy and a sense that you're really getting a lot of information just based on the fact that they have this kind of access and they have this tool in digital video where they can just keep the camera running all the time.
I think it's also, I don't know if anyone's ever not aware that the camera is not on in Wiener, but it's a lot less intrusive. You know, you have to light up the room for a 16mm. I mean, you know, I guess they're using found light for that, but still, you know, you have a larger camera and it's running and it's making noise. Mm-hmm. With Wiener, you don't. And there's no way that doesn't affect what you get on camera.
And I think also just kind of where we are in a society, we're much more used, whether you're in the public eye or not, you're much more used to, like, being recorded and publicly sharing. Like, we are a society that shares publicly on social media and podcasts. And, you know, like, yeah. I think just like there's been a shift in what we as human beings think we should share with the world. And I mean, obviously that differs from individual to individual. Huma Abedin being a very good example of someone who maybe does not have that feeling. But I think there is in Wiener a much more natural acceptance of being recorded, both as kind of the way things are with politics and celebrity and just kind of as human beings being used to being recorded.
And I think we do, one of the advantages that Wiener has is that I think you do kind of stumble into these scenes of really startling intimacy that may not have been as possible when you're selecting specific moments to have the camera on. When it's on all the time, you get stuff like, you know, this Carlos Danger thing breaking out and Huma and Wiener, you know, sitting in a room together trying to troubleshoot, I suppose, the situation that is immediately perilous politically, and then, of course, is personally devastating as well. And it gets to a point where the camera's like the last party to leave the room at that point. But you really, that tension, that's extraordinary to witness. And in the scene that we were talking about earlier, of being in that room when he's watching himself on The Last Word, and she reacts the way she does. You know, other scenes where she reacts to him just silently, where you catch her in the corner of the camera and you get her body language and her facial expressions. That's pretty stunning stuff to witness, and I think that is something that a small camera that is running all the time and is ever present, that's the sort of stuff you can get.
But both films also do manage to find a lot of little grace notes and moments of humor, too. Like, you know, we talked about in the War Room, the Bush beer moment or the thing with the bottle of whiskey, you know. And there's stuff like that, too, in Wiener. Like the moment when he and Huma are, like, comparing ingredient labels on, like, spaghetti sauce, you know. Like, or something that's not even humorous like that, but, like, at the end when we're... when the camera's like, it's like a full on chase scene between Sydney Leathers and Anthony Wiener, like on election night, and she's trying to confront him and he's like making an escape through McDonald's. And oh, just like, God. So in that case, I think just the versatility of digital video is a real asset, and that the camera is able to kind of follow this as it develops. But yeah, I think the point I was trying to make is that it is kind of extraordinary given this limitation that Wiener does not have, that the War Room is able to find those little grace notes.
Yeah, that is true. And I'm really glad that you brought up the scene where they're reading the ingredients to each other, because that is a marriage. Like, that is an actual scene, just a light piece of banter that they've surely engaged in before. And it's a private joke, or it's kind of a thing that they do. And it was nice to have that included in the movie, because so much of it is about crisis, and so much of it makes you think about them as a political couple and not a real couple, not a real marriage. And that's a scene that enforces the fact that it is a real marriage.
And at the same time, it deepens the tragedy.
Yeah.
Because we see that this is an actual relationship that's going to fall apart.
And there is the specter of their little toddler always in the frame, you know, too. Well, not always in the frame, but we do see a lot of that kid, and it's
rough. Yeah.
You know. Oh, and like on election day when they have that whole little conflict over like taking the kid out, because like Huma does not want to leave, so he just like takes the kid out in the stroller to like walk the streets on election day, and it's like so clearly a photo op that Huma wants no part of.
Yeah. Her withdrawing from some of those things too, like the commercial that he's shooting, and she doesn't want anything to do with that. It's fascinating to see that because there is she does, you know, the good wife thing mm-hmm. when the news breaks and she joins him at that press conference. And I think she does her absolute best for him, but it's she's not comfortable in that moment.
Nor should she be.
Exactly. But
dying inside is the correct phrase.
Yeah. Yeah. But then you see it just deteriorating from there, that relationship and her feelings about, can this work? The answer just becomes more and more no as you get away from that moment.
Well, and I think that speaks to another connection I wanted to talk about, was how the media functions in both of these films. And the media is kind of an antagonist in both of these films, much more so in Wiener. I think the tabloid press is pretty squarely positioned as a villain, particularly mm-hmm. when it comes to Huma and her reaction, and his communications director, Barbara, who has to like kind of absorb a lot of the media attention kind of on his behalf. And there's that one part where they're like having a staff huddle, and they're talking about leaving and the optics of if Huma leaves and if Barbara leaves. And one of the staffers like recounts something a tabloid, either photographer or writer, like shouted at her earlier, is like, if you don't answer our questions, we're going to write that you're having an affair. Like, just this idea of the press just salivating over every little thing that's happening. And we get a little of that in the war room too, but it's kind of a much more jovial kind of antagonism, I think, especially coming from Carville, who just like there's that early scene where they're talking about, I don't think it's actually Carville that says it, but talking about the schizophrenic newspaper that'll like write something and then say the exact opposite yeah. thing in the op-ed. And there's a, you know, a fair bit of smack talking against the press that always getting it wrong in the war room and all that. But yeah, I think given that we are members of the media to a very different degree than the media in both of these movies, but that does always kind of stick out to me in thinking about both of these films.
There's also the changes in the media between mm-hmm. them. Carville's tailoring what he has for sound bites on the news, mm-hmm. and by the time you get to Wiener, even that is kind of looking antiquated with the internet and social media, and the internet and all that.
With the kids and their computers.
The cyber.
Yeah.
They're both fascinating historical documents. I suspect, you know, Wiener will eventually look as the war room looks now, which is kind of quaint in some ways.
Yeah. Would the Wiener scandal have been what it was if his name wasn't so ripe for New York Post headlines? Uh-huh. Like the headlines we see in that movie are, there's something.
They are. Although, I mean, you know, it's a thing where he does live and die by the media.
Oh, yeah.
It's not as if he doesn't benefit hugely from their attention. And I think that the story of his political comeback as a pugnacious fighter, a New Yorker who's flawed but unbowed, that's a story that the media is perfectly happy to tell, you know,
something juicier.
Yeah, right, until something happens, and then the name again becomes an albatross. But I think his career is scuttled either way.
Yeah, yeah.
And it gets to a point where his behavior is so self-destructive, that confrontation at the Jewish deli is rough. though, as Jon Stewart noted, that guy kind of had it coming.
He was kind of acting on Huma's behalf in that moment, although whether that was the correct way to deal with such a situation speaks to the character issues we were talking about earlier.
No, right. I mean, that's... He's got the best temperament. Anthony Weiner. He's got the best temperament.
New York politician.
Yeah. Yeah, boy, I guess so. I guess they are. I guess both Trump and Weiner both are. They're New York politicians to the core. But I guess one thing I would say about the media, and this is just the style of the two films, too, is that The War Room, there's a certain rigor to the filmmaking in terms of perspective. And it's like, we're going to show you the campaign from the war room, from this vantage, and the information that you're going to get about where the campaign is at, you're going to get it filtered through the sort of lens that they're seeing it filtered through. So if Ross Perot is reentering the campaign, you know, that little bank of televisions that on the wall, that's where how you're going to learn that information. Whereas Weiner is a lot more open to like throwing in clips from Howard Stern or from the news broadcasts or tabloid headlines, a little more, I would say, a lot more conventional a film than The War Room. I mean, not to slag it.
I do think that approach in Weiner does kind of contribute to the sense of oppressiveness of the media attention by having so much of it in so many different forms of it, you know, and it serves a different effect. And conventional or not, it doesn't really matter. It serves the story that the documentary is telling.
No, it does. It does. I don't want to rag on Weiner. have we talked enough? This isn't really a connection, but have we talked enough about Sidney Leathers? Has that whole incident been brought up? Because, I mean, you think about low points, and I think when you have just lost the New York City primary with less than 5% of the vote, and the big concern from anyone in the campaign is devising a McDonald's strategy for avoiding this Sidney Leathers confrontation at your farewell reception. That's pretty low.
Yeah.
I'm going to say running through the McDonald's.
Welcome to New York. Yep. That's what he says.
Oh, God.
So is Sidney Leathers his Jennifer Flowers or his Monica Lewinsky? Or neither? I guess neither.
I think closer to Lewinsky in a way because... Well, Lewinsky didn't undo Clinton, but was, I think, ultimately a bigger albatross around his neck.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
Well, I mean, they had never met, right? I mean, this was all a virtual.
Yeah, I mean, obviously, like, the situations are very different, but I'm talking in terms of the effect on one's political legacy.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think either one really impacted the candidates in a way, because with just the whole notion that he had done it again, you know, no matter who it's with, that he had these communications, I think that was enough. In the Carlos Danger thing, I mean, that's what people were paying attention to. I mean, the Sidney Leathers confrontation, that's something I really just learned from watching this film, that I was not aware of her at all. I was aware of these sexts that he had sent out and aware of his alter ego, but not really of her in the same way. And of course, you know, really, obviously the Lewinsky scandal got Clinton impeached, but didn't really affect him in the practical.
In the end, he left effect. A highly popular president.
He did. So I don't know what that tells you.
So what did we learn?
this has suddenly become the end of Burn After Reading. We learned never to do it again. That's the line, right? Well, you learn never to do it again. Close the file.
This was a fun, terrible trip down memory lane.
It really was. But we can close the book, I think, on the Clintons at this point.
Yeah.
We at the Next Picture Show are doing it.
We will probably not be devoting any more episodes to movies about them.
I should think not. But you never know.
We have their Primary Colors. What can we pair with Primary Colors?
Yeah, you know, it's possible. Primary Colors is interesting.
That might
come up at another juncture. But in the meantime, you can find The War Room on DVD and Blu-ray as part of the Criterion Collection. It's also streaming on Filmstruck, and it's available for rent through the usual places. Weiner is currently on Showtime and is available for a fee on streaming sites like iTunes. We will be right back with our usual recommendation segment, Your Next Picture Show. Mm-hmm. Finally, it's time to catch each other up on films or film-related items we've seen in the interim since our last podcast. We call it Your Next Picture Show in the hopes that it'll put some interesting choices on your radar. Genevieve, you want to kick us off? What in the film world has been good for you lately?
I want to start in the spirit of Tasha Robinson, who is not here with us this week. I would like to recommend some supplementary viewing to this week's episode, the first of which is fairly tangential, but always a good thing to recommend, which is the 30 Rock episode Secrets and Lies, which features an appearance from one James Carville, Cajun style.
Yeah.
And the plot of the episode has to do with Alec Baldwin's character, Jack Donaghy, who is a very conservative figure, having a illicit romance with a liberal figure played by Edie Falco. And James Carville comes in to offer some guidance to the situation, which, given what we know about him, is a pretty brilliant cameo. And it's a really fun cameo. I actually, just by pure happenstance, my boyfriend and I have been watching 30 Rock before bed. Which is very comforting.
Good idea. Very smart.
Yes.
Idea.
Just by pure happenstance, we happened to watch that episode the same day that I watched The War Room. So great little bit of serendipity. And it's a great episode. It's one of the series' best. So Secrets and Lies, always go back to that. And then something a little newer that very explicitly references The War Room is the Documentary Now episode titled The Bunker. Documentary Now is an IFC series that, if you like documentary film, you should definitely have on your radar. It is kind of masterminded by Fred Armisen, Bill Hader, and John Mulaney of...
I didn't know it was Mulaney. I thought it was Seth Meyers. Seth Meyers? Okay.
Oh, yeah. John Mulaney wrote the episode recommending, but that whole little SNL cabal of that era is all involved in some way or another. But anyway, The Bunker is the name of the episode that is directly referencing The War Room, where Fred Armisen plays a George Stephanopoulos character who is named Alvin Panagoulias. and Bill Hader is the James Carville character who's named Teddy Redbones. And Hader in particular is just having a ton of fun in this episode. It is a comedy, it is a spoof, and they are dealing with a problematic in a different way candidate in this. I won't give away too much, but it does have some scenes that directly reference certain scenes in The War Room, probably the most notable of which is when everyone's going around doing impressions of people. There's a nice moment in The Bunker that references that. So, yeah, Documentary Now episode The Bunker. Now, for my actual recommendation of a movie...
This is Tasha-esque.
I know, right? Sorry, guys. I'll make it quick. We're coming up on Valentine's Day, which is when we recommend romantic comedies, of which there are not that many recommendable ones. So I would like to recommend a really good rom-com that I rewatched recently called What If from 2013, starring Daniel Radcliffe and Zoe Kazan. Originally, I believe, known as the F word. Yes. Mm-hmm. It's a riff on the When Harry Met Sally formula, kind of the idea of, can people be friends or who have a sexual attraction to each other? But in my opinion, does much more interesting things with that formula. And also, there's no Billy Crystal shtick in it. Daniel Radcliffe is a interesting romantic lead. His character here is kind of purposely awkward, and I think Zoe Kazan is pretty great in it. But what I really like about this movie is how it handles the grand romantic gesture and kind of points out how unrealistic a lot of grand romantic gestures in rom-coms are and how kind of creepy they would be in a lot of contexts. So also Adam Driver and Mackenzie Davis are in it, and they are great supporting cast in it. So it's just a great little funny rom-com. I highly recommend it for just a kind of low stakes watch with someone you love, or just yourself. It is currently streaming on Showtime if you have that, and then it's also rentable via the usual platforms as well. What If?
I saw that at Toronto when it was called The F Word. It's a Canadian film.
Mm-hmm.
And
Director of Goon.
Adam Driver and Mackenzie Davis are incredible. Yeah. And that was my first exposure to Mackenzie Davis, who is one of my absolute favorites. And also, your reference to romantic comedy behavior, I have to bring up the Onion headline. Romantic comedy behavior gets real life man arrested.
Yep.
Which is absolutely dead on.
Classic.
Classic Onion headline. Keith, what about you?
Oh, gosh. I saw a lot of really good movies in January.
Name them all.
I'm going to name all of them. You know what movie I watched today, though? I had a little time between work and here. I watched Dirty Dancing.
Oh.
So it's better than I remember it being. I actually think it's really good for like an hour and 15 minutes, and the end is really weird and strange and not good. But
I quote that movie every summer when I buy watermelon, and I say I carried a watermelon.
But that was fun. Now, you know what? You did not recommend The Red Turtle, so I will recommend The Red Turtle, which is close between Studio Ghibli, the Japanese giant of wonderful animation that brought us such films as Spirited Away and Kiki's Delivery Service and My Neighbor Totoro, and the British Dutch director Mikael Dudok de Wit, who I believe is in his 60s. This is his first feature. He's done a lot of shorts. It's a nice fit, though. It's not the usual Ghibli style, but it is a very complimentary sensibility. There is no dialogue in it. It's the story of a man who is shipwrecked on an island and tries to get off, and finds his attempts foiled by a beautiful red turtle. And I don't really... How much did she give away in your review?
I struggled with whether to give away what the red turtle is, but ultimately decided that the trailers for the movie give it away. I feel like it is essentially part of the premise, even though it is kind of treated as a reveal.
Well, you know what? I did not give it away. Yeah. I walked up to that line and said, you're going to have to find out the rest for yourself. So I'm going to do that here. But it is a wonderful film about the circle of life, to quote another animated classic, and the passing of one generation to another. And it is just full of beautiful imagery. I wish I watched it at home. I'd like to see it again on the big screen.
Yeah, me too.
Because it is a stunning looking film. So I'd say not for your youngest viewers, but I'd say your more mature, you know, your 7-8-year-old types. I think your older daughter would enjoy it, and Lily would be confused and bored. I think my kid would have been confused and bored too.
Lily would be my youngest.
That's right.
Yes, she would.
Yeah, I would go into it not placing too much stock or expectation in the Ghibli connection. There's a little bit in the tone that I think you can trace back, but it is a very different film. I think the animation style is more European than Japanese, for one thing. But it's such like a deliberately paced film. And I think maybe that is a little bit where you get the Ghibli influence, especially Takahata, the co-founder of Ghibli, probably the lesser known after Miyazaki. Takahata was the director of Grave of the Fireflies, which is, if you are familiar with that film, will kind of give you a sense of the different sensibility he brings to it. So he basically just consulted with DeWitt on how to expand this idea to a feature length. Actually, our own Tasha Robinson reported on a Q&A from a Toronto International Film Festival screening of this movie. And he talks a little about the Ghibli connection and makes clear that like neither he nor Takahata were kind of emulating that style. So yeah, my point is, don't place too much stock in that, even though it is technically a Ghibli co-production.
I think it fits right in, though. I mean, I think
it's not like the next Ghibli film that you've been waiting for. You know, it's its own thing, and that's what's so great about it. It is beautiful in a way that I have not experienced in animation recently. It's this almost like children's storybook style, but rendered so lushly, and it has this amazing interaction and reverence for the natural world, and as we see on this island where this man ends up. And yeah, I loved it. I reviewed it for Vox.com. I wrote a movie review,
hey,
you guys.
Yay!
And I gave it the big old 5 V's. So
that's the most V's you can get.
Vox rating.
Yep. So cosine.
Okay.
Scott, how about you?
I wanted to recommend the film Gleason. I didn't catch Gleason when it was in theaters because I saw the trailer. I felt like the trailer made it look like a run-of-the-mill inspirational sports documentary. In this case, a documentary about an ex-NFL player, Steve Gleason, who was diagnosed with ALS and was sort of determined to live his last days to the fullest. And while there's an element of that in Gleason's impulse to make a visual diary for his son, much like Michael Keaton in the movie My Life, I was stunned by how rich Gleason the documentary turned out to be. The camera doesn't just capture those moments when Gleason is overcoming adversity or nobly going about his charity work. It also gets into these extraordinarily intimate and often ugly emotional scenes where he's dealing with pain, depression, marital difficulties, and a real struggle with faith. At times, It feels like suddenly a Mike Lee movie just busts out. And there's scenes, especially between him and his dad. His dad is a very fundamentalist Christian. You know, he tries to, there's a scene where his dad takes him to try to get healed publicly, this public healing that goes horribly, horribly awry. And there are scenes between father and son that reminded me of like East of Eden, like that level of intensity. It's on Amazon Prime. It's not, you know, the most perfectly directed documentary. It's not going to wow you in that respect, but there are moments that just destroyed me. This is like Manchester by the Sea tissue factor for you. So be prepared for a major emotional impact, but also be prepared for a film that, at least for me, was a lot more interesting than it appeared to be. So, Gleason.
I haven't seen it. Have you, Keith?
Nope. It's been on my list. I know other people who have seen it and loved it.
I believe Tasha is a fan, too. Like, I could be wrong, yeah. But...
No, I mean, I think it would be very hard to dislike it. But I think it does have some really extraordinary moments in it.
Good. I'll check it out
for that. And that's it for this week's edition of The Next Picture Show. Our next episodes come out February 21st and 23rd. Keith, what do we have lined up?
For our next episodes, we'll be looking at movies featuring the Caped Crusader, the Dark Knight Detective, one half of the dynamic duo. I'm talking about the one and only Batman. Except, as we'll no doubt discuss, there is no one and only Batman, but many different versions of Batman. We're going to focus on two of them. Tim Burton's 1989 summer blockbuster Batman, which introduced moviegoers to a grimmer and more serious incarnation of the character than most had encountered before. And the Lego Batman movie, which looks to be, in part, one long elaborate goof on that grimdark Batman.
In the meantime, we'd love to hear your feedback on this week's discussion of The War Room and Wiener and anything else film-related. We want to include your thoughts on future episodes of the show. You can leave a short voicemail at 773-234-9730 or email us at comments@nextpictureshow.net. Finally, before closing out this week's episodes, where can we find everyone these days? Genevieve Kosky.
I am behind the scenes and occasionally in front of the scenes at Vox.com at the culture section there. You can find me on Twitter and at Letterboxd at Genevieve Kosky.
Keith Phipps.
I am also similarly often behind the scenes and sometimes in front of the scenes where I work, which is uprocks.com. You can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000.
Scott, what about you?
Well, I'm all over the place as usual. You can find me at New York Times, Vulture. I've got something going for Guardian up soon. I got another thing going for Washington Post, Uprocks, other such fine publications. I'm the editor-in-chief of Musings. We're in the middle of our Produced and Abandoned series, which is going great. By the time this is out, Keith Phipps will have contributed to that, OC and Stigs.
Yeah,
right, Keith?
I'm totally done with that piece already.
Yeah, right. it's in my inbox. That's fantastic. Thank you, Keith. So you're looking forward to that. I think there's a lot. It's been great because we've had a lot of really good writers writing about films they are passionate about that were not necessarily celebrated at the time. We got Angelica Jade Bastian on By the Sea, and you got Mike D'Angelo on The Counselor, Judy Berman on Velvet Goldmine, and then you on OC and Sticks.
Do you want me to write about The Chipmunk Adventure?
The next time we do the Produced and Abandoned series, Genevieve, I will definitely hit you up on that. So you can stay updated on The Next Picture Show via Twitter at Next Picture Pod, via Facebook at facebook.com/Next Picture Show, or by visiting nextpictureshow.net. And if you haven't already, please subscribe to the show on iTunes. And while you're there, think about rating and reviewing us. Seriously, think about it.
And then do it.
Yeah, come on now. I want, like, I don't know, food in the mail or something. Every thumbs up helps us find... No, here's what I want. I want the fancy underwear. Guys, rate and review us so I can get some fancy underwear. Every thumbs up helps us find new listeners and keeps the show going. Thanks to Colin the Animal Griffith for his assistance producing the show. And thanks to Genevieve Kosky's apartment for providing recording space at her home base. Her apartment. The Next Picture Show is proud to be a part of the Film Spotting family of podcasts and the Panoply Network. Please tune in next time. Here I am.